Hello. Thank you for being here. My name is Christina Shockley. I'm the Morning Edition host at Michigan Radio. Just in case you don't know, it sounds like you do, but in case you don't know, Michigan Radio is the NPR affiliate based here in Ann Arbor. We cover the southern portion of the Lower Peninsula. In Grand Rapids, we're 104.1. In Flint, we're 91.1. And in Ann Arbor, Detroit, we're 91.7. And, of course, MichiganRadio.org. And on behalf of Michigan Radio, I am pleased and honored to explain that we are partnering with the Ann Arbor District Library to bring you Helen Thomas this evening. I think someone who is especially looked up to in my profession, and I think especially among women in my profession. There's one thing that I want to mention, and for fans of A Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion will be in Detroit on Saturday, February 27th, 2010. And for more information about that, you can visit MichiganRadio.org. So again, thank you very much for being here. And here's the director of the Ann Arbor District Library, Josie Parker.
Good evening, everyone. The first thing I'm going to do is to ask all of you to check again to make sure that you've turned off your cell phones or put them on silent. And I will wait while you do that, because I do not want to shush you in this program. I will say one thing about Christina Shockley while you do that. We claim Christina at the library. When I became director of the library, Christina was our switchboard operator in the evenings and the weekends while she was trying to get going at U of M radio. And so when I listen to her now in the early morning, I used to call at night and get Christina's voice. Now I listen in the morning and say to my husband, "That's Christina Shockley." And he said, "Yes, Josie, I know." So I was delighted to have Christina introduce me this evening. I want to welcome all of you, including those of you who've made it up into the balcony, to our, the balcony. The library program had the balcony open up. Doesn't get much better than that. To this event this evening, we are pleased to partner with Michigan Radio to bring all of you to the Michigan Theater. I know many of you have traveled away to get here, so my introduction of Helen Thomas will be short and sweet in respect for the types of questions that she asked. She is someone I think the journalism profession holds up as an icon of the way to do it, but she also is for libraries and librarians, someone who understands the democratic principle that the library is founded on in this country, and she supports it. And I find it very moving to be a librarian, introducing someone like Helen Thomas to you this evening, and I'm very pleased to do it. So listen up, Michigan, Helen Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If elected, I will serve. I'd like to say that that's the shortest obituary I've had. I enjoyed it. And I'm very grateful to the Ann Arbor District Library for giving me the opportunity to harangue you. Good evening. It's always good to be home again, and I know Michigan is bearing the brunt of a deep recession, or is it a deep depression? For the jobless, I'm sure, Detroit seems like the end of the road. Detroit helped save the country and the world during World War II with its transformation from the auto assembly lines to an arsenal for the United States. and its allies against the spread of fascism throughout the world. I know it will rise again because of the great fortitude of the people I've seen in Michigan and grew up with. And I feel that right now the country, of course, needs a lot of help. I love books and history books. And at the White House, we are recording instant history every day. On the quietest day, I fasten my seatbelt. The other shoe is bound to fall. As long as people are on this planet, there's never a day without news. And although we seem to thrive on bad news, it seems even more so now. There's no question that President Obama has inherited the wind. Two wars yet to be explained or even defined, in Iraq and Afghanistan. A collapsed economy with outside joblessness, poverty, hunger. And we read today that a federal report saying we have 50 million people who are hungry. There's something wrong with this picture. In my glib way, I have a lot of advice for Obama. Get out of those wars. The president should declare a victory and leave Afghanistan and Iraq. Stop the wanton killing and dying halfway around the world. Yes, Saddam Hussein was ruthless, but women had jobs, children went to school, the homes had electricity and clean water. Thousands of Iraqis and Americans are dead. Thousands. 2 million displaced and living in camps. Nearly 5,000 Americans dead, and some 30,000 wounded during the ongoing 7 years of war in Iraq. Former President George Bush's explanations for the invasion, weapons of mass destruction, ties between Saddam and the al-Qaeda terrorist network, and threats about a third world country against the world's only military superpower. All falsehoods. So why aren't Americans asking more questions? And as for President Bush's regime, he has put the albatross of torture around our necks, torture of prisoners. As for Afghanistan, the country has been invaded many, many times, but survived it through the centuries. The armed attacks on their tribal society. The president apparently has decided to send, according to the rumors from Washington, 34,000 more troops to Afghanistan. That's a little less than the commander there, McChrystal, who asked for 40,000 more forces. And news leaks indicate that he has decided, after many months of pondering the whole question, he has decided to send more troops. A wrong decision. The U.S. ambassador to Kabul, who was top military commander in Afghanistan for a couple of years, is cautioning against the escalation. As late as the 1980s, the former well-armed Soviet Union was forced to give up its occupation of Afghanistan. Afghans and a lot of other people fight for their land. Where in the hell are they supposed to go? We should declare a victory, as I said. That's what we're doing in Iraq under any other name. But it would take a profile in courage for Obama to do the same in Afghanistan. Republicans are bound to pounce on him and call it a surrender if he did pull out. They started the wars without even the benefit of a congressional approval. As for the economy, well, the president made sure that the big banks would not fail. With taxpayer bailout money, and banks are holding on to the money and refusing small business loans to build up their assets. As for the greedy Wall Street, their big bonuses and stock handles are getting bigger all the time. And now we come to universal health care, another big problem. I can't believe the heartlessness of Congress, playing politics with those who are deprived of medicine, health care, 47 million people in this country without any insurance. At the same time, members of Congress pay a pittance for almost day-to-day coverage, health care coverage, round the clock. We should have Medicare for everyone, single payer. Why would anyone in Congress reject a government plan when they wallow in their medical perks? Should the poor and the sick be deprived in a country as rich as ours? The Congresswomen who say they can't bring themselves to vote for the government option, and Senator Lieberman, a so-called independent, says his opposition to a government-run insurance is a matter of conscience. If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. We ought to look up the campaign donations from the big health insurance companies who are spending millions to kill the government plan. Also in foreign policy, Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had first laid down the law that there should be a freeze on settlements in the occupied West Bank, but they caved in to the Israeli land grab and they gave a green light for the settlers to continue building 3,000 new homes on Palestinian land. So what else is new? It's against international law to annex occupied land. In my book, great presidents have strong conscience with a moral compass. I went to the White House on John F. Kennedy's inaugural day, and I never left. The man who came to dinner. It's a great beat for reporters. Kennedy was my favorite president because I thought he was inspired. He grew in office, he learned from his mistakes, and he left a legacy of the Peace Corps, which he created. He signed the first nuclear test ban treaty, and he set a goal of landing men on the moon in a decade. Didn't live to see it, but we did it. He went to the nuclear brink with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, and both of them pulled back. It's what we call statesmanship. They made a deal. The Russians pulled their missiles out of Cuba, and 6 months later, we pulled ours out of Turkey, which were pointed toward the Soviet Union. During his first year in office, President Kennedy invited the first class of astronauts and their wives to come to the White House for an informal dinner. He said to them during the mix and mingle, do you think we could land men on the moon in a decade? They said, sure, absolutely. You never say no to a president. When they left, they said, is this guy nuts? Crazy? Kennedy was witty, smart, and he had known war. At a news conference, his first one, live on television, he told us, life is unfair. Lyndon B. Johnson also showed greatness on the domestic side. But of course, the Vietnam War was his political undoing. Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? But while he was in office, he moved the mountain on the domestic side. In his first two years in office, on the tailwind of the Kennedy assassination, he was able to ram through Congress Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal aid to education at all levels, starting with Head Start through college, public housing, the Great Society. Richard Nixon made the breakthrough trip to China, but the Watergate scandal forced him to be the first president in American history to resign from office. His successor, Gerald Ford, told us that the long national nightmare was over, meaning Watergate. Jimmy Carter led helped to reach the first Camp David Accords on the Middle East to find Middle East peace, the peace process, and has won the Nobel Peace Prize. Because of his work, he's the best past president we've had in modern times. Obama has won the Nobel Peace Prize too, to his and our surprise. Ronald Reagan turned the country to the right, and he helped end the Cold War. He really believed in trickle-down, and he never turned his back on Dixon, Illinois, once he got to Hollywood. The first President Bush won the first Gulf War and had the good sense not to go on to Baghdad. And the reason he said he didn't go was he thought that there might be civil war. House-to-house fighting. Can you imagine that? President Clinton left office with a surplus in the Treasury. He thought the worst days in the White House were really good. He loved being president, but he became entangled with an intern in the White House, and he won't wind up on Mount Rushmore. George W. Bush wanted to be a war president. He was, what price glory. As for Obama, the return not all in. His heart is in the right place, but he needs more courage to do the right thing. And I fear he has lost his great goals. More killing, more dying around the world. I do have to bemoan the dying newspaper business overtaken by high technology and money. Those in the field are looking for answers of how to survive. Everyone with a laptop these days thinks they're a journalist. And everyone with a cell phone thinks they're a photographer. But the would-be reporters can ruin lives and reputations without good editors. Accuracy is supposed to be everything in our field. As the cliche goes, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. Now I think I should lighten up, don't you? I came to Washington determined to be a reporter, and Liz Carpenter, who later became a great Texas reporter, came at the same time from the University of Texas. She had been editor of her paper, and later on she became press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson. Well, Liz was always on the plump side, who wasn't then, and we went knocking on doors at the National Press Building looking for jobs. And Liz ran out of money a couple days before I did, And she wired her brother, please send me $200 or I'm going to have to sell my body. She later told me to the Smithsonian, but I don't believe her. Her brother wired back, sell it by the pound. but he did send the money. Another favorite story of mine was told to me by Phil Drury, who worked for the Voice of America. She started out working for a small Virginia paper, and she recalled that she used to call the funeral director every day and ask if anyone important had died. And the funeral director told her, everyone is important to someone. And then there was the Cub reporter who was sent to cover the Johnstown flood, his first big story. And he really knew he had to make good, and he telegraphed his story to the editor, and he said, God sat on the bank of the Johnstown River today and cried. His editor wrote back, forget the flood, interview God. President Johnson, like all presidents, had a stable of speechwriters. He asked that a certain speech be prepared for his down-home crowd. The speechwriter brought him the first draft, and Johnson looked at it, and he said, Voltaire, people I'm going to talk to don't know who Voltaire is. He grabbed a pen, scratched out Voltaire, and scribbled in, as my dear old daddy used to say. And once LBJ asked Bill Moyers, who had been a Baptist minister and later became his press secretary, to say grace at dinner at the LBJ ranch. Moyers bent his head, began to pray, and Johnson commanded, speak up, Bill. I wasn't talking to you, Mr. President, Moyers said. During the Carter era, Midge Costanza headed the White House division that kept in touch with outside groups, women, ethnics, and so on. And she was quoted as saying, I don't mind Carter being born again, but did he have to come back as himself? Then there was Miss Lillian, Carter's mother, who was questioned one day about a French woman correspondent who belabored Carter's campaign promise never to lie. Kept asking Miss Lillian, what do you really mean by that? Finally, she said to Miss Lillian, do you lie? Miss Lillian said, well, might tell a little white lie. Well, what do you mean by a little white lie? In total exasperation, Miss Lillian said, you remember when you came through that door and I told you how beautiful you looked? Well, that's a little white lie. During the Martin Luther King March on Washington, and when he made his famous I Have a Dream speech. But I remember even more the cameo appearance by a rabbi who had spent many years in a Nazi concentration camp. And he said, the greatest sin of all in the Nazi era was silence. Silence. When the leading Nazis appeared at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, they said to the prosecutors, we're on trial because we lost the war. No, said Robert Jackson, the chief U.S. prosecutor, who later became a justice at the Supreme Court. He told them, he said, you're on trial because you started a war. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy went to American University, and he told the students, America, America would never start a war. So ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for all of us. Thank you very much. I'll be very happy to take your questions. Thank you. Thank you. With some help. Thank you.
Ms. Thomas will take questions. There are microphones on each side of the stage here. Anyone who has a question can step up to the microphone.
Hello.
Hi.
Who runs the media?
Wall Street right now. I never thought I'd say this, but in the good old days, a family would run a newspaper. Their contribution, the newspaper was a contribution to the community. They never expected to make Bonanza 25% profits, which Wall Street's now demanding. If they got 12%, 10%, it was fine because they made their money in real estate or mining. But I think everything has changed now. Newspapers are going down the drain, and I think it's a tragedy. I can't live without a newspaper. The pros are looking for a solution, but they really haven't found one yet. We've got to teach the young people to get off those computers and start reading newspapers.
What is your favorite part about being a reporter?
What is your favorite part about being a reporter?
Curiosity. Nosiness. I think the great thing about my profession, and I'm so lucky, is that it's an education every day. You keep learning. You have to keep learning. You have to care. And I do think that you cannot have, I know this is a cliche, you cannot have a democracy without an informed people. And you have to have reporters out there. You have to have reporters out there doing the legwork, asking the questions, especially of the powers of be, that be. I like to ask presidents questions that make them very unhappy. And my favorite question of all is why.
We'll alternate sides on the microphones, so go ahead.
You're making me want to think of a question that would make you very unhappy, but I can't that quickly.
Are you the president?
No, not yet. I wondered if you could talk about your first decade or two at the White House. I imagine through the 60s and 70s, you met with a lot of barriers against women in your profession. And I'd just like to hear some of your stories about that. And if you could tell us, what were some of the key moments or key tactics that you used that really helped break the glass ceiling among White House correspondents?
Well, I think it was, of course, women in all the professions after World War II, especially in law, medicine, journalism, and so forth, were great discriminations. Even Sandra O'Connor started out as a secretary and wound up as Supreme Court Justice. There's always been injustice against women workers. World War II, they found out that they were taking every man who could breathe. If he had a pulse, he was going to war. And suddenly they discovered women could do these jobs, a lot of them. But my favorites are the suffragettes who marched 70 years. They were chained to the White House fence. They went to jail and so forth to get the vote. And finally, they got it. But it should not have taken that long, and it should have been in the Constitution. Well, as for myself, I came from an immigrant family. My parents were, they first came from Syria. By the time after World War I, it became Lebanon. So they couldn't read or write, but they wanted all their children, 9 children, to have an education, and we all went to college. They really valued the education, but they never told me it was a man's world. And when I decided when I got on the school paper, my ego swelled. I was a sophomore. I saw my byline and said, "This is it." I decided then and there that I loved working as a reporter and the great congeniality of working on a paper and the good friendships and so forth. So it was World War II, and I decided to come to Washington. Well, there was discrimination, but they needed us, so it became different. And when they became, I covered Justice Department and all the federal departments, and the great interest in the Kennedy family boosted me to go to the White House. And I sort of assigned myself, and I stayed there. And I decided they needed me. There's never a day without news, and as long as people are on this planet, and I found that everything comes to the White House, whether it's Tricky Track, The Most Trivial, or War and Peace. So you're always covering history, and you're always alive, and you think you're doing something for the world. You really mislead yourself.
On the way over here, I was telling my granddaughter about your unique role in ending the presidential press conferences for so many years, and she asked me, well, how did you know when to do it? I mean, did you get a signal from the president or an advance saying that it'll be 45 minutes, Helen, and that's it? Or did you decide for yourself a certain time? Or did you say, all the good questions have been answered, let's get out of here? What made you how did you decide that?
Good question. It was always by prearrangement between the White House and the network, so you wouldn't miss all as the world turns and so forth. So the press conferences were usually limited to a half hour, and I would wear 2 watches and make sure that I could cut it off in the right time and make enough enemies among the reporters. So you can imagine, everyone comes armed with their favorite question. But the first time I signed off on a news conference for the president, it was my boss was out of town, so the privilege of saying thank you was mine. And so I saw that Kennedy was getting wound up, kept talking, couldn't find the answer to the question. And so I decided, I got up and I said, thank you, Mr. President. He said, thank you. Wound up. So I did him a favor. But another time when I got up to close the news conference, and Mary McGrory, a great reporter, all got up the same time. And President Reagan had been talking about tithing to your church. So he picked her to ask her a question, which is fine with me. The more the merrier, the longer, and so forth. But she said, well, Mr. President, how much do you tithe? He turned to me and he said, I should have taken your quiz. I should have had your advice. Saved him.
Hi. I'm wondering, we haven't had our own newspaper here in town since the spring, and it seems like things are going to naturally devolve because people are less well-informed, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that it's really a tragedy. I think newspapers give you the story in depth. You get sound bites from the television, and more you're getting really biased I shouldn't talk because I wrote for more than 50 years for a wire service with just the facts, ma'am. Now I write an opinion column, and when the editor first looked at it, he said, where's the edge? I said, what? Your opinion. My what? So now I wake up every morning and I say, who do I hate today? That's the way you write a column. But the point is that I don't think you can get the straight stories, or certainly not in depth, from TV, and something has to work out. I mean, the magazines are trying, but nothing can replace a good newspaper. I think The New York Times still gives you a pretty good cursory sign of what's going on, and the Washington Post. But even they are cutting down. They used to have bureaus everywhere in the world, practically. No more. It's a question of money.
We don't really have the kind of local coverage that you would want either, because the news and the free press aren't going to cover our community unless somebody goes postal.
Local coverage is lacking.
Well, that's true. Everything's lacking, in my opinion, as long as we're stuck with electronic journalism. Breaking news, then all of a sudden the breaking news, and they put it in a commercial, and you hold your breath. What is this breaking news? I mean, this is it's very hyped. Everything is hyped. And there's no such thing as a situation room. It's really in the White House, not at CNN.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello, my name is Thomas Partridge, and it's an honor to ask you a question. I'd like to ask you to compare the news coverage of the healthcare reform movement in this country, in Congress, and in town forums around the country to the passage of the 1960 Medicare and Medicaid acts that you referred to earlier, the similarities and contrast, and to ask you pointedly if you do not think that the Democratic Party liberals' attempts to pass a fair health care reform bill with a public service component, I would prefer to refer to rather than a public option, is not being undermined by newspaper publishers and TV station producers in the reporting of this national debate.
I think you've got the wrong culprit. The health insurance companies are pouring millions every week to distort the picture. The death panels, is it wrong? I mean, the propaganda has been so... If you tell a lie often enough, I mean, it sticks. I think that the people have been so misinformed. White House has made a very bad job by not presenting a formal proposal and not really showing any dedication to the public option. I think whatever reason, President Obama has not fought for it. And I kept asking questions every day at the briefings. Why does the president really support the public option? You asked that question yesterday. You asked that question the day before. And you asked that question the day before. I said, I'm still waiting for an answer. No, they botched it back because when Hillary Clinton was in charge of health care during their administration, she really didn't touch base with Congress, and she drafted a legislation in the dark, practically, without really cluing herself into Capitol Hill. And President Obama is trying to make up for those mistakes to schmooze with all the congressmen and not presenting a real plan himself. And I think he's let the insurance companies take over and spook everyone. And look, Social Security works. Medicare works. Nobody in this country should lack for medicine and health care. It's a basic right. Who wants the children to go without vaccinations and everything else? We owe it to each other. And it can't be a good society at all unless we really do the right thing by everyone. We should have a government, whether it's competitive or not, but it should be available for everyone. Medicare for everyone.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for speaking with us tonight, and thanks for the great questions that you ask in your work. I was curious about something you said earlier in your talk, when you said, you asked, why aren't Americans asking more questions? And I have a personal opinion of the answer to that. I think that we don't really, we feel kind of alienated from social change. We don't really think that we can make a difference by asking questions. Even though we do have some really great instances of Americans making social change recently. But I was wondering what you think. Why do you think we're not asking more questions?
I think we have lapsed into a passivity. I like the fact in during Vietnam, everybody hit the streets, mothers, children, so forth. They thought it was wrong and they did something about it. I think we've all been frightened by 9/11, the constant publicity of terrorism and so forth. People have retreated to their own homes and so forth. There is no unity in this country. It's very, very divided. The right wing are making sure that we are scared of everything, afraid of everything. I never have seen really great unity in this country since World War II. Everyone understood why we had to go to war. Everyone understood the purpose. Everyone sacrificed. Today, there is no such unity and there is no unifier. Where are the peacemakers? Who are we? What have we become? A bunch of people watching television entertainment tonight, or who's the best dancer? I mean, I shouldn't say that because Abby, my companion, loves that program. No, I really think that we have to get much more involved. We have to care more. I mean, presidents have to listen to the people, but they won't listen to them unless they hit the streets and unless they really do something. And we've all retreated into our shells out of fear. And fear has been used against us, I think. We're not really the people we once were, and we should care about one another. We are our brother's keeper in every sense of the word. And I just feel sorry because I don't see any great leaders around.
All right. I was just wondering, you accompanied Nixon on his historic visit to China. So how'd you compare that with President Obama's recent visit to China?
We've made China very rich, so they can tell us to go to hell. I mean, they're holding all the cards. I think that's why you see this kind of standoffishness. We can't dictate to the rest of the world anymore because we are in so much debt, into wars that we shouldn't be in, so forth. So I think it was not a failure because it really was a get acquainted trip for all the Asian leaders and so forth. And I think Obama still is very popular and very respected, but the real clout, they're beginning to wonder if we have it. We have really given all our productivity away, possibilities and so forth. We produce nothing. We're losing on that ground, and yet we have the great brains, I believe, to become great entrepreneurs again. So they can tell us off.
First, thank you for all your years of service. I think you really do have made a difference for a very long time, and many of us really appreciate that. My question is...
Thank you. Thank you. We were a cabal. Women I knew, we were all a cabal. We were fighting all the time.
So for those of us who are not political scientists or politicians, how do you recommend that with the information that we do have available, we cut through what is good information and cut out what is, you know, just fed to us and it may seem like the truth but is stretched thin? Do you have any advice for how to read the news as a good listener?
Yeah, I think you have to read a lot. I think you should read the New York Times and Post or things or The Nation and so forth. And read both sides of the question, and I think you have to make up your own mind. I think without newspapers, it's really going to be a big lack in this country. But on the other hand, if you were stuck with the editorials of the Detroit News only, you would be very limited, too.
Thank you.
Since you're a woman who broke so much ground, I wanted to ask what you think it would take for a woman to break the glass ceiling to become president, or when you think that might happen and how.
What would it take
for a woman to break the glass ceiling to become president?
Well, I don't want Sarah, but... but I think that Hillary got as close as you can, and I think it's one more step. I think definitely we will see many women presidents in this century, in the 21st century, definitely. I never saw anyone get that close. Obama cut into the line. She was supposed to get it. But that's life.
First, thank you for holding all the past presidents accountable with your tough questions. What was the toughest question you ever asked that you got a straight answer to?
Toughest question. I asked President Bush, why did we go to war? And he said, 9/11. I said, no. I said, there were no Iraqis in 9/11, so why did you go into... And he kept repeating. I think that was a tough question. I stay awake at night thinking, how can I get them this time? I think that I did ask President Obama, and he hasn't called on me again since. I said, do you know of any country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons? He said, I don't want to speculate. I said, I didn't ask you to speculate. How come you know what Iran has? How come you know what North Korea has? How come you know what everybody else has? So I think that it's very hard to think of what tough questions, although President Nixon told me that he liked tough questions. I really wonder about that. But once he was holding a news conference and I had been named bureau chief at UPI at the White House, big deal. I mean, I had two people on the staff in the bureau. But anyway, he complimented me at the start of a news conference. And I came armed with a question about what was on the tape on March 23, which was very... very damning to him. And I really felt bad. I hesitated to ask him, because here I was being complimented by a president and I was going to spit in his eye. And I thought, what can the American people think of me to be so brutal without, after being so, he was so nice. But then I thought, well, flattery will get you everywhere. And what will your colleagues think? So I asked the question.
First of all, I think I saw you out to lunch today in 6 Mile and Hagerty in Livonia, so possibly. Maybe not, but if I'm glad I didn't say, hi, Helen Thomas. I want to know, you mentioned before Sarah Palin. What do you think of her chances in the celebrity culture that she might be able to, that she, obviously this crowd is, and nor am I a fan, but she does seem to have a rabid following. And does she have a shot maybe for the Republican nomination in 2012?
I think that she certainly, I mean, she's sold 1.5 million books now, so she certainly has some fans. And I think that, I don't know what her aspirations really are, but I do think that she's not ready. I want everyone to have great aspirations, but I'm a little wary. I know that Katie Couric asked her what she read, and she couldn't even say that, and that was a very telling point, in that when I had to introduce Katie Couric last year at a lunch, at a dinner, I said she saved the country. I know I'm coming across as very mean, and I don't mean to be, but I think she can handle me.
Helen, thank you for being here. And I don't think you come across mean. Would you be able to, if you had to make a cogent argument that Fox News is a legitimate news operation?
Sure.
Okay.
It is. It certainly is a news coverage in its own style. They have called me everything. Hezbollah, Hamas, terrorists, and so forth. And I tell them, consider the source.
A brief follow-up. What about WorldNet Daily? WND. Do you know that organization?
The which one? I'm not familiar with it.
It's an online only organization. Perhaps you haven't read it. Thank you.
Hi. As a woman with so much gusto yourself, do you have any suggestions for President Obama to show some courage and regain the respect of the world when he goes to accept his Nobel Peace Prize and then hopefully goes to the climate change negotiations in Copenhagen? Suggestions for Obama to show courage?
Forget the next term. Do the right thing. In this case, I really think that he does know the right. There is a right and wrong. I do believe in relativity, but in this case, in terms of what's right, what's wrong, it's wrong to kill. It's wrong to keep killing without any explanation of why and so forth. I don't understand. I know he's being advised by a lot of the military people, but when you think that the U.S. commander to Kabul had been the military commander in Afghanistan for I don't know how long, and he said, don't. He says, be cautious, be careful. He knows. I mean, Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great, the Brits, the Russians couldn't do it. Why should we do it? And why should we send thousands of people there to do it? And what is the real purpose? Probably pipelines through Afghanistan to avoid China and India and Iran and so forth. And I think we've fed the military-industrial complex enough. Halliburton, no bids, billions and billions of dollars for all the services they gave, 100,000 private contractors, mercenaries in Iraq. I mean, we used to fight war for a purpose. You had to have a reason to die. Ours not to ask why. Ours but to do and die.
It's 8 o'clock. Would you like to take two more?
A few more.
Yes. Okay. All right, go ahead.
You spoke earlier a little bit about how you felt about technology in regards to newspapers, but I was wondering what you felt about the Educate to Innovate program that Obama spoke about, I think, yesterday.
I think that, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what he's proposed. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
He spoke about how he wants middle schoolers and high schoolers to become, kind of create an interest in science, mathematics, and technology, like different fields, like get them interested in those fields for jobs and to follow them throughout college and stuff.
I think that's a great idea. I'm with Obama on that. That's one of the things. No, I'm sorry, I'm too ignorant of what's really... I do regret the emphasis on science and math and no civics and no history and so forth, which is so... I mean... We have to know what's going on in our country. Our lives depend on it. And everything isn't high tech, and you see everybody always with their Twitters and so forth. What is this? What's going on? No conversation. Or there is conversation. 127 words?
Take a question right now.
Okay.
I wanted to compliment you on your dramatic performance that you did with Colbert in the film.
That was fun.
And, you know, when I saw the tape, the President Bush looked a little uncomfortable that evening, and he put on a brave face. He, you know, tried to act like he was enjoying it, but you could tell that it was a false face. But anyway, after that, it seemed to me that he was a little humbled for the rest of his administration, it seemed to me. And you were there that night. You were in closer contact with him. Do you think that he was humbled? Did it finally get through to him that night? Or was it just in my head?
Reporters were very embarrassed because they felt the president was being insulted so that they didn't dare laugh. But I was roaring. And I felt bad because Colbert had all his family there, everybody dressed beautifully and so forth, and they were going to watch this son, favorite son, play this great role. And it fell like a lead balloon. But later on, he got a lot of good publicity out of it.
He took on the press, too. He was, he was tough on them also.
Oh, he was, but he's right.
Damning with faint praise or whatever, you know. Yeah.
I think it was very valid.
But do you think the president's tone, or he seemed humbler after that. Do you think that is true or not?
I think was the president more humble after that?
Hell no.
Thank you.
Humble is not a word you attach to him. Maybe a few other things, but not that. No, I think he's very proud of himself. Okay. One track mind.
Take one right here.
Hello. Have you ever met a president that was able to make good on his campaign promises? Or should we believe that everything that a candidate says is simply rhetoric?
No, I haven't met anyone who really lives up to their campaign. But it's very different in the Oval Office than on the campaign trail. What was the last part of your question?
If we should simply believe that what the candidates say is rhetoric and take it with a grain of salt.
Well, I'm a born cynic with hope. I do think that people do believe, I think that President Obama did a very unusual thing in being able to rally young people to get interested in politics and to want it to happen. And that was great. And I do think the promises are not just in the sky. I think he really meant them. But once you get in the office, Oval Office, the roof falls in, and you realize you have to make, and too many times now he has followed Bush's footsteps, and I think that's wrong.
Thank you, Dean.
Wiretapping and so forth, rendition, sending people to be tortured in other countries. Who are we? Why isn't there an uproar? So horrifying.
Well, my question is has to do with journalism, but the role that journalism plays in educating us as to what is really truly going on. As you stated that the war is probably something that has more to do with pipelines than it has to do with Al-Qaeda or anything else. Who holds journalists accountable? If you're a lawyer, you've got this board, you know, you can be debarred, you know, and so on and so forth. Who is it that holds journalists accountable? How can journalists be accountable for giving us the right kind of education that we need so that we can make better decisions and we can let the president know what it is that we want, you know, to really happen there? Because as it stands, we don't have any real alternatives or any information to weigh out. What are our alternatives and to be able to advise the president in that way? So I feel like part of the responsibility, yes, of course, is us to be informed, but journalists have the responsibility to give us the information that we can't access ourselves. So who holds journalists accountable, and how can we take part in holding them accountable for the kind of information they give us?
You obviously do hold accountable, and the people do. I can assure you, if you're a journalist, at least in the old days, if you wrote an untruth in the story deliberately to embellish the story or whatever, you would not have a job the next day. It was that tight and that tough, and it still is. Accuracy is everything. As for presidents, I don't waste my sympathy on them. They ask for it in every sense of the word. They're not Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. They know what the problems are. They may not know the extent of them, and it may be very difficult to make decisions, but I'll never forget in Plains, Georgia, we were watching President Carter on his front porch. We were across the street, and his youngest son, Carter's youngest son, came over and said to the photographer, said to him, "Don't you feel sorry for your dad? All of us watching and so forth." He said, "No, he asked for it." And it's really true. They have to be accountable. Who else is it? They have the whole world in their hands. Our lives. No, I don't waste my sympathy on them.
Yeah,
they have every possibility to do the right thing.
The accountability I'm asking about is the journalist's accountability. In terms of giving us the information that we need. For instance, somebody says to the president, is it the Al-Qaeda or is it the pipelines that we're actually after here? And being able to kind of really grab so to speak, to give us the right information, the true information, so that we can stand up and say, no, this is not what we want.
You're trying to hold journalists responsible for asking a tough question when the president won't answer it?
Well, if it's the truth, they ask the question.
What they learn is how to avoid answering questions like that.
Okay.
Especially if they really are crucifying them. No. The biggest problem for reporters is secrecy. The secrecy in government, which is all pervasive. And it hits the candidate as soon as he steps into the Oval Office, he becomes very secretive. Everything is their secret. The color of the walls, everything. It's just amazing. And they hold on to it, and they hate leaks. This president resented the fact that someone leaked to a reporter the very fact that the U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan was against sending more troops there. That's a fact that we should know and know very well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Two more questions, one here and one there.
First of all, I would like to make a comment, and that is that as a former journalist, I used you and Jane Pauley and the Barbara Walters as examples of how I could develop my interviewing skills in my career, and I want to thank you for that. I grew up watching you on the various press conferences over these years, and you're truly an icon and an inspiration to
thank you.
How I held myself as a reporter. Second of all, now I've transitioned from being a newspaper reporter to a teacher, and while I work as a substitute teacher in the Ann Arbor District, I still am a certified teacher, and I want to know, going back to the Clinton administration, if the North American Free Trade Agreement had not been signed and brought into law, do you think that our current financial crisis would have evolved differently?
NAFTA?
Well, I thought I believed in these international treaties and everything, but I don't believe in giving away the store. So I think there has to be some adjustments about that. But I think the real cause of our financial catastrophe is the Republicans. The biggest tax cuts, can you imagine the biggest tax cuts going to the richest people? And no regulation on the SEC, no regulation of Wall Street or anything else. They could see the storm coming, and they didn't give a damn.
I agree with you with that statement, but I also have to give partial credit to Bill Clinton, because when he signed the NAFTA, that's when industry started going across country lines and fleeing from the United States.
I have an observation and then a question. The observation is that when I get to be your age, I hope I have one-tenth of the savvy that you have.
Thank you. I'm pretty rickety. Thank you.
And my question is, I was very pleased that you referred to Jimmy Carter as the best of our past presidents. He's one of my heroes. I would love it if you'd say a few more words about his administration.
I think he was very misunderstood. He didn't know how to, even though he had a Democratic Congress, He didn't know how to really schmooze with them. The leaders came out the same door they went in, meaning there was no connection. Somehow he was a loner, and he didn't quite belong in their ideas. I'd never have seen such a disconnect between Congress, of your own party, and the president. So I think that was a fault. He seemed to be much better as a past president. And he really has been pilloried. He's done so many good things, though, since then. And he did. I think his wife took it harder, their defeat. But he just sailed on, and I think he has a spiritual guidance. He's very religious.
Thank you for your questions. Ms. Thomas
He's
will.
Very good on the Middle East.
Sorry. Okay. Thank you for your questions. Ms. Thomas will sign books at the table up on stage if you would form a single line. And I'd like to thank you very much for coming this evening.